Hello and welcome to Volume 104 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll talk about some interesting research on pine trees that has just started, and we'll talk about some research that's just concluded, which shows how important the forest economy is to the state and the nation. And we'll talk about rattlesnakes, and we'll learn about some ideas about how to keep the family forest together for generations. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Our next guest is Gary Lemme, who's a director of the Alabama Cooperative Extension. The Extension System and others have published a book that outlines the economic impact of farms and forests. Welcome, Gary.
Good morning, Hayes.
Tell me why you think this book is important.
It's really important for everyone to understand the economic impact of agriculture and forestry on our economy in Alabama and our employment, both from the perspective of those people in Montgomery who are our state legislators, but also from the general public.
Well, with that in mind, then what is the impact of the forest industry on the economy in Alabama?
Well, combined, agriculture and forestry are responsible for $70.4 billion of economic activity. That is 40% of the economic activity that occurs in Alabama. And we're responsible for 22% of the employment in Alabama. Now, if we take a look at focus just on the forestry industries, the forestry industries are responsible for $21.4 billion worth of economic activity every year in Alabama. That's 12% of our state's gross domestic product.
Okay. Now, you've commented on the relationship between the production of forest products and the processing of forest products. Can you tease out that distinction for us, please?
Yes, and that's very important because in Alabama, of that $11.2 billion of economic activity, $1 billion comes from the commercial logging phase, and $10.2 billion comes from the forest product manufacturing. In other words, 91% of the income and economic activity in forestry in Alabama is related to the manufacturing processing side of the industry. Now, of course, paper is by far the most important. Paper mills have a direct economic impact of $3.8 billion and employ 37,809 jobs directly and indirectly. So you have those industries that are supporting the mills themselves. After the paper mills, the paper board mills are second with $2.5 billion. The sawmills and wood preservation is in another $1.1 billion. The paperboard container manufacturing is $719 million, and the pulp mills are $364 million.
Okay, well, those are certainly impressive numbers, and we appreciate the work of the Alabama Cooperative Extension and others in putting this together. Thanks, Gary.
Thank you.
Some forest owners have noticed that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has a program that encourages the use of biofuels, but it doesn't welcome homegrown family forests as one of the fuels. And so a bill has been introduced in Congress to correct this. It's called the Forest Products Fairness Act. And so we've asked Melissa Muller to tell us about it. Hello, Melissa.
Hello.
Melissa, tell us why you think the Forest Products Fairness Act is needed.
Well, we all know it's important for forest owners to have access to markets to sell the wood from their land. When landowners go to sell their wood, they definitely want to get a good return on their investment as well as all of the hard work that they put into growing that. But it doesn't just mean money in their pocket. It also means landowner can continue to improve habitat for wildlife and protect water quality and keep their forest as a forest. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, the USDA BioPreferred program, there are some government policies that have been put in place that actually hurt forest products in the marketplace. Some of you may be familiar with green building policies that discourage the use of wood. This issue is similar, but slightly different. As you mentioned, the U.S. Department of Agriculture does have a program called the BioPreferred program, and the goal is simply just to promote products that are made out of bio-based materials. It encourages the federal government to use bio-based products in their work, but it also puts a label on these products in the marketplace, sort of similar to the USDA organic label that you see in the grocery stores. This all sounds great because forest products are bio-based and are some of the most bio-based products out there. Unfortunately, as the program's been rolled out, most forest products have been excluded for the program. And it's especially a problem because some competing products that are made from materials like bamboo and even hemp get the label, but American family-grown forest products are included. The Forest Products Fairness Act simply says, include these forest products in the program. From pulp and paper and paperboard to pellets, wood, and lumber products, make sure that they're all included in the bio-preferred program.
So it's really a branding process, isn't it? Something called bio-preferred with the little registered trademark symbol by it, and it's a shorthand way of saying, you know, the things that we associate with biofuels are present in these products. But you think forests are missing from that equation?
They are. They've really put an emphasis in the program on new and emerging products. So some of the more innovative products that have been made from, you know, soy products and corn products and different things, they really emphasize that new and innovative piece. But unfortunately, forest products we think should be included in the program too.
Okay. Well, if someone wanted to help build support for the changes that you're talking about in the Act, and the Act is called Forest Products Fairness Act, how would a person go about that?
Sure. Senators Mark Pryor from Arkansas and Roy Blunt from Missouri and Representatives Glenn Thompson from Pennsylvania and Kurt Schrader from Oregon introduced the Forest Products Fairness Act earlier this month. And so far there are about 53 co-sponsors in the House, and the Senate bill has 8 co-sponsors. Neither of the Alabama senators have co-sponsored yet, but Representatives Joe Bonner, Martha Roby, Mike Rogers, Robert Adderholt, and Terry Sewell have all agreed to be co-sponsors. We would love to get the entire Alabama delegation on this bill, and you can send a simple email to your representative and your senators at www.familyforestaction.org. And if your member is already on the bill, please be sure to thank them for that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Melissa. We appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we've learned of some federally funded research to see how climate change affects carbon sequestration in planted pines. And so we've asked Dr. Tim Martin, who's leading a group of researchers, to introduce this research project. It's called Pine Map. Hello, Tim.
Hi, Hayes. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me about the size of Pine Map in terms of dollars and how long the project lasts and how much research time is involved in it.
Great. Pine Map, and I want to point out, Pine Map stands for Pine Integrated Network Education, Mitigation, and Adaptation Project. And that project is funded by the USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture. It's a 5-year, $20 million project. There are more than 50 scientists involved, and they come from 11 southeastern land-grant universities as well as the Forest Service. Another really important set of entities that are involved in the research is the main research cooperatives in the region. So research cooperatives are joint ventures between corporate landowners, forest landowners, and universities to do research together that's usually long-term. And we have 8 of the major cooperatives involved: 3 breeding cooperatives, 2 growth and yield cooperatives, a couple of silviculture cooperatives, and an economics and policy cooperative. And together, those entities manage about 20 million acres of planted pine in the region and produce 95% of the pine seedlings in the region that are planted. So those are really important partners in our efforts.
Okay. Well, given the financial realities that we hear about every day, on television, you learn it's important to scrutinize these sorts of federal expenditures. What is it about this project that is supposed to produce, you know, results for forest landowners and actually taxpayers?
That's a great question. And really, the agency that funded this, NIFA and the USDA, one of the reasons these are so big is that they wanted these projects to produce outcomes in the real world. So when they asked for proposals for these projects, they said, demonstrate to us how what you do will change in a positive way the management of this resource in the real world. And that's how our project is structured. And those research cooperatives that I mentioned, are really key to making that happen. So we, the people involved in this project, have been working with these cooperatives for sometimes decades. So we already have trust and relationships with the corporate side. In addition, the Southern Regional Extension Forester basically helps coordinate forestry extension work to non-corporate landowners in the region, and he's also a central player in this project. So those are sort of the two main conduits for getting information that's useful to landowners out into their hands so that they can use them. So let me give you a couple of examples of some of the products that PineMap will produce that should be useful for people that own forest land. There's a group that's working on a new comprehensive growth and yield model for loblolly pine that'll take into account, you know, all the usual things, site factor, site index, and so on, as well as climatic factors like rainfall and temperature. An important thing here is that that modeling team is using data that is shared among all of those research cooperatives in the region. And this isn't something that's ever been done before, and this federal funding provides an umbrella where those co-ops can come together and basically create a data set that's region-wide that has never been assembled before, and that's pretty powerful. Another example, there's a group testing slow-release fertilizers that they're predicting may increase the efficiency of fertilizer application by as much as 50%. So that really will reduce fertilizer costs and make growing trees more efficient, cost-effective.
Okay. Can you give me an idea about the climate change threat to loblolly pine and whether it's significant enough to warrant studying the issue in the first place?
Yes. Probably the greatest threat to southern forestry that's associated with predicted climate change and climate variability is really changes to disturbance frequency and intensity. So things like wildfire, windstorms, severe drought, exotic and native disease dynamics, and so on are all affected by climate. Now, predicting how those things will change with climate change is still uncertain. But, you know, the fact is we already deal with all of those disturbances in southern forestry already. So PineMap research is really designed to help southern landowners deal with those kinds of disturbances and manage their forests to be more resilient in the face of these disturbances that we face. So that's really the best way to prepare for uncertainty associated with disturbance and climate in the future.
All right. Well, go ahead, Tim.
Mm-hmm. So really the tagline that we have for the PineMap project is mapping the future of southern pine management for a changing world. And that's really what we're trying to do is to help southern forest landowners manage really an asset that's of huge value and importance for our culture and our region. We're striving to produce the knowledge that's necessary to keep those forests resilient and an asset for society.
All right. Well, thank you, Tim. We appreciate that.
Thanks. Really appreciate the opportunity.
An updated version of the Forest Landowner's Guide to Federal Income Tax has just been released, so we've asked John Green, a frequent contributor to Capital Ideas Live, to tell us about it. Welcome, John.
Thank you, Hayes.
Where do forest landowners go to get a copy of the new income tax guide?
Well, Hayes, it's only available as a PDF file so far at the Internet addresses in my paragraph on the page for today's webcast. But paper copies should be available for purchase from the government printing office within the next few weeks.
Okay. Does the new guide cover any new topics that weren't addressed in past versions?
Yes, it does, Hayes. There's an entirely new chapter on non-timber forest products and a new appendix that gives line-by-line instructions about how to fill out IRS Form T. Also, there's new information on the reforestation tax incentives, on lump sum sales of timber under Section 631B of the Internal Revenue Code, on qualified joint ventures between married couples, and on electronic filing.
Well, with all those new topics, is there any room for the old topics?
Of course, Hayes. The guide still includes up-to-date information on tax planning, on the different types of forest costs and income, like-kind exchanges, on deductible losses and conservation easements, Christmas tree production, forms of forest ownership, about how to research a tax question and where to go for tax help and how to keep forest records.
Okay, good. Well, I remember at the end of last year, 2012, there was a lot of uncertainty, and I was wondering about this new guide, how far it takes us in that process and whether or not it includes the most recent changes that have just passed.
Well, the guide is entirely up to date for filing returns for 2012 Hays, but of course the authors couldn't anticipate the new taxes and rates in the American Taxpayer Relief Act that passed in January or any other tax laws that might be passed as a result of the budget negotiations going on in Washington right now. So Linda Wong and I are going to have to address those in the tax tips for the 2013 tax year when we write it in September.
Okay, in September. All right. Well, thanks, John. We appreciate that.
My pleasure, Hayes.
Remember that the purpose behind the Endangered Species Act is to protect entire species of animals and plants. Some of them are sympathetic, like polar bears, but some of them are downright unsympathetic, like rattlesnakes. Ben Wigley is with Nick Casey, and he's with us to explain what the Endangered Species Act has to do with snakes. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks, Hayes. Good morning.
Ben, is it true that Fish and Wildlife Service is being asked to list the eastern diamondback rattlesnake, and if so, why?
That's absolutely correct. It's an unusual situation, but in August 2011, the Fish and Wildlife Service received what we call a petition from several environmental groups asking the service to list the eastern diamondback rattlesnake federally as threatened or endangered, and the group that organized that petition was the Center for Biological Diversity. The center said in their petition that the snake needs to be listed for a couple of reasons. One is because it's declined in abundance and its range has shrunk, according to them, because humans kill snakes during encounters or have run over them accidentally or intentionally with their vehicles. And then secondly, they expressed concerns about several issues related to forest. The primary forest-related reason was that they say open canopy longleaf pine savannas have been replaced with agricultural land uses and urban land uses or closed canopy forests. When you read the petition very carefully, it's pretty clear that the Center for Biological Diversity and their friends, rightly or wrongly, are particularly concerned about rattlesnake roundups, which used to be fairly common in the Southeast, and they're worried about the commercial trade in rattlesnake skins. But they also are concerned about suppression of fire in forest and the conversion of forest to other land uses and pine plantation management.
Okay.
At this point, I'll mention one other thing, Hayes. At this point, it's not entirely clear how listing would affect landowners. We know from listings of other species, like the spotted owl, that it can have a huge impact on landowners' ability to manage their forest. So we have every reason to suspect that that will happen and then in this case, but it's not entirely certain at this point.
What role does Nikasi play in this process?
Well, Nikasi is the National Council for Air and Stream Improvement. We're a nonprofit research institute that focuses on environmental topics of interest to the industry. At this point, we are organizing a survey to solicit information about observations of eastern diamondback rattlesnakes. And based on the information that we have, some of it is anecdotal evidence, we think that eastern diamondbacks are quite common in managed forest and are not exclusively found in longleaf pine savannas. And so we're asking people to complete our survey and describe the forest where they encounter snakes. And we think by doing that, it will help the Fish and Wildlife Service make a more informed decision about whether they should list the species, and if they do, what type of constraints may or may not be appropriate for forests.
How soon is a decision expected?
It's not entirely clear. Technically, they should have already made the decision by now, but the Center for Biological Diversity has tied the service up with so many other petitions and lawsuits that they're way behind schedule. Right now, we're thinking that it may be 2015 or 2016 before they actually make a decision, which is a good thing because that gives us time to gather information such as this survey and maybe even do research if it's appropriate.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Ben. We appreciate that. Professor Dave Jones recently wrote an article on wood identification, and it caught our eye, so we wanted to talk with him. Hello, Dave.
Hey, how are you?
So, wood identification, isn't it true that all woods are pretty much the same?
Well, you would think they would be. Chemically, they're all basically the same. They're all made of cellulose and the hemicelluloses and lignins, the things we make paper and other chemical products out of, and the thing that gives us the strength. But actually, they're all very, very different, and the structures in them are different.
Tell me why that's the case. Why is there such differentiation among different types of wood? I mean, most people just see a tree and think it's a tree, or a piece of wood and think it's a piece of wood. So why are they different?
Well, so wood serves two major functions in a tree. And the way that I describe it is the very first function is to hold the leaves way high up into the air so that they get lots of sunlight to be able to grow through photosynthesis. And then the second function of wood in a tree is to move water from the ground up to those leaves to help them do photosynthesis again. And so what's happened over time is different trees have adapted to different sites and evolved to live in those different sites so that what they had to do in order to maintain that water flow and that strength and hold those leaves up high is they formed different anatomical parts, just like lots of other plants that we're used to seeing. The only difference between trees and other plants is it's mostly on the inside that those differences occur. And so that's why woods are very, very different anatomically and is so that they can survive on different places. That's why bottomland hardwoods are different than upland hardwoods and why pines grow well on particular sites and not so well on others.
Well, then, how do these different properties of trees that you're describing, how does it allow you to tell the different species apart?
Well, so in hardwoods, you basically have several different types of cells in there. You have tracheids, and you have fibers, and you have rays, and you have vessels or pores. And those things are in almost all hardwoods. And again, their function is mainly to move water, maybe some to store some food. But the size and combination and how they're arranged in the wood itself is what helps you do the identification. And so many of us that do wood ID on a regular basis have a key that we go through and we go, well, is this present? What does it look like? If it is, if we move to the next question and move through. So it's a very methodical way of doing it. And so we can identify woods apart. Now, there is some breakdown on it. It's like southern yellow pine. Once you knock the bark and the needles off, you can't tell the southern pines apart. The same thing holds true for red oaks. You knock the leaves and bark off, and you can't tell one red oak from another anatomically. The same with white oaks. So while you can tell certain species apart, we do have to go with species groups for some because they're just not anatomically different enough to separate them out.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dave. We appreciate that. Our next guest is Professor Tom McAvoy. Tom has written a book about family planning. Well, not that kind of family planning, but the kind that keeps the family farm or forest together for generations. Welcome, Tom.
Thank you, Hayes.
Tom, I noticed your book heavily used a form, you know, called case studies, and that was the way that you conveyed the content. Why did you organize the book this way?
In the mid-80s, we hosted a workshop over the course of, it was 3 days over a couple of months, and it involved 16 families coming to learn about how to keep their lands intact and in the family. And during the course of the numerous evaluations we did throughout the workshop, I discovered that it was the coming together of the group through the telling of their secrets that really helped others over hurdles in terms of their own planning. And from this, I got the idea that if I was able to obtain case studies from people from around the United States, showing their successes, their missteps, and even some of their failures, that it might help people understand that this is not easy stuff, but it's the stuff that they have to do if their plan is to keep the land intact and in the family.
All right. Well, why don't you tell me some more about the book?
Well, the book is called Planting Family Forests, and the subtitle is How to Keep Woodlands Intact and in the Family. The emphasis, of course, is on how to keep woodlands intact. Most of the case studies I came across, representing every major timber type in the United States, were families that had learned how to pass the land on to the next generation. In other words, they were only thinking one generation ahead, and what I was looking for were case studies that involved multiple generations, entities that families had set up, like S-corporations or closely held S-corps, limited liability companies, and the like, that would allow the family to sort of take over in the stead of the previous generation and keep the lands intact and hopefully in the family.
How do you think those ideas that you've expressed in the book are going to help family forests move their ball down the field and keep the forest intact for generations?
I think that the case studies, of which 12 of them have been expanded into chapters and then another 10 have been presented as what I call case study fragments, because everybody had something. There was at least one thing they had that was an object lesson for others that are trying to do this planning. The case study approach allows families that are now contemplating doing this to look through and find those case studies that best represent not only what they want to do, but the family dynamics that a person has been beset with, the troublesome brother, the sister who wants nothing to do with it, the children who've already calculated what your estate is worth in dollars when your goal is to keep the land and forest. And so what I try to do is sort of run the gamut of experiences to give everyone an opportunity to sort of find the match that seems to work best for them.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tom. We appreciate that, and we enjoy talking with you.
My pleasure.
And our markets chair is James Yike, who has written about thinking of your land in investment terms. Welcome, James.
Hey, great to be here, Hayes. Thanks.
Why is it important to think of your land in terms of an investment?
Well, Hayes, we know people own woodlands for many important reasons, and they reap many returns in the form of enhanced wildlife habitat, recreation, joy of ownership, or a legacy to pass on to family members. However, income earned from timber production is an objective most landowners wish to achieve from at least part of their property. When this is the case, it's important that timber be viewed as any other investment to make sure it's earning the best return. When the return rate drops below that of other investments, it may be best to harvest or invest the money elsewhere and regenerate a new timber investment. We call this point in time the financial maturity of the stand. As most landowners only sell timber from a particular stand once or maybe twice in their lifetime, then it's important that they use the financial maturity of the timber as a guide.
Okay, then how do you determine financial maturity of a tree, a single tree, or even of a stand?
Well, in our article, what we do is we boil down some basic forest management concepts to give landowners a simple and effective tool to determine when their stand reaches a maturity of financial value when it's compared to other investments. Basically, your timber increases in value in two different ways, through biological growth and through the market value of the timber. Biological volume growth is measured through mean annual growth rates in the timber stand. It typically starts off fast, then it levels off and it starts to decline. In pine saw timber, we see this usually happening in around 25 to 30 years. In the meantime, inflation and relative scarcity of saw timber, it regularly increases in market value. So what we do is provide a simple way to express both the volume and the market value growth as annual compound interest rates. The timber volume growth estimations we use are relied on measurements that are easily obtained by a professional forester, the market value growth is a function of the most recent 10-year price ratio of sawtimber. So we walk people through in this article how to get this information and then provide them lookup tables of the percent annual compound interest so that they can compare that with other investment opportunities. When the combination of those two annual interest rates fall below those of other investments, then it's time to start thinking about doing something with that stand.
Okay. Well, the economy's been kind of up and down, down for a long period of time, and now recently just, you know, back up if you're looking at the stock market. Is timber still a good investment under these conditions?
Yes, it is, and it's much better than cypresses right now, by the way, you have on your website.
Right.
There certainly has been a slump in demand, and obviously, and that's decreased the market value of wood. From 2001 to 2011, for instance, the price ratio was a negative 4% annual interest rate on pine saw timber. Not good. However, if your timber is growing well, say it's 6% compounded in annually, you're still keeping current with other investment opportunities. And as we know, and as what we're seeing, housing and other timber-based markets are increasing slowly, but they are increasing. And that only adds to that annual increase of the compound interest, making it, so the market value of timber is definitely continuing to grow. And it's continuing to make it a safe and very successful investment. It's only when the timber volume growth declines that we really start seeing the need to start doing some thinning or some final harvesting.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Gary Lemme, Melissa Mahler, Tim Martin, and John Green. We also appreciate the contributions of Ben Wigley, Dave Jones, James Yike, and Tom McAvoy. Historians often use natural resources as a way of organizing different time periods. The Bronze Age, the Wood Age, the Industrial Age, these are all thought to be different and distinct periods of time. In his book, Wood, A History, author Joachim Radkau shows how the Industrial Age actually overlapped the Wood Age. And in his review of the book, Jared Farmer has stated that industrial countries of the 18th and 19th century used more wood per capita than any other societies, in the form of salt works, iron works, glass works, colonial shipyards, and early railroads. All of those consumed a mountain of trees. In the long run, coal, iron and steel, concrete did diminish wood's importance. But however, in the late 20th century, the chemical industry ushered in a postmodern wooden age. And so today, arboreal biomass, engineered into pulp, plywood, fiberboard, and chipboard, is now a major global resource and a cutting-edge building material. We live in a renaissance of wood. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.